From Autosport.com and Autosport Magazine, I'm Kevin Turner, and this is the Autosport National Podcast. Hey, good morning, everyone. Welcome to Super Touring Power 3 in the live stage today. And with me, two special guests. First of all, Super Touring star Patrick Watts and 2022 British Touring Car champion Tom Ingram. So, welcome, chaps. Thank you for joining us. We're going to start with Tom because you've had a roller coaster ride already this weekend. You've had to switch from your front wheel drive Hyundai to a Group A rear wheel drive Ford RS500. First of all, how have you found it, the changing from one to the other? And also, can you talk us through the various trials and tribulations you've had already in the last 36 hours?
One of the things I've now discovered since driving these things is these guys had enormous set of confidence skills.
Bravery.
And bravery.
Bollocks?
No, couldn't say that. They're terrifying things, I'll be honest with you. It's an eye-opening experience to drive. I drove it for the first time on Friday around the Indy Circuit on old tyres, and it was terrifying, I'll be honest with you. You never got a chance to breathe. You never got a chance to relax because you've got a corner coming. It's a gear change. It's in boost. It's out of boost. There's always something going on. As soon as we got to the GP loop, oh, nice. I could enjoy this. But there are no crossovers. You can't even say, well, the Hyundai does that better and this does it. This definitely has more power. After that, there are no similarities that you can take from it other than you're on a circuit that you know. So it's a completely different driving style. It's a completely different way of performing. But they're a hell of a car to be able to drive. They're really, really cool.
Now, you made a really modest start yesterday and you were 5.2 seconds clear at the end of the first lap. Which is rather good, but after that you had a bit more of a tricky time. So yeah, tell us what happened.
We had a fuel pressure based issue, which, as Patrick will know, there's always a term and an excuse. Now, if we were to say a fuel pressure based issue, would suggest maybe not enough fuel in it, huh? Who said that? But we may or may not have had enough fuel in the car to complete. To complete the race distance, and that might have been our fuel pressure based issue.
Yeah, it's hard to have fuel pressure when you haven't got any fuel in the system.
Yeah.
And then this morning as well.
In fairness, what I think it was where the pickup is in the tank is in a weird place. So we had like 20 litres in it, but it just didn't finish the race. So yeah, so we had a great start, and then by the end of lap one, it was coughing and spluttering, and there was a sort of a certain inevitability about the situation that was going on.
I mean, on a book of excuses, that is one that definitely is not your fault.
It's definitely not my fault.
You did they entrust you with filling up with fuel?
No, nobody would do that.
It wasn't your fault.
No, because it would definitely have been a fuel pressure based issue if I'd have filled it up.
Conrod's coming through the side of the block, probably the driver's fault. You know, smashed up clutch, gearbox, probably the driver's fault. Fuel pressure, you're in the clear, mate.
Not my fault.
Patrick, one thing I wanted to ask you is, obviously we're talking about Super Touring a lot this weekend, but actually it's also the first time the British Touring cars became one category, as in one class. So overall results are what mattered. But of course, before that, you could win the championship from the lower classes. So, and I know that the MG Metro that you're demonstrating this weekend is close to your heart. So do you think it's a shame that we lost that multi-class format, or do you think it, on balance, it was a sensible thing?
No. When I first started watching when I was racing in one mate racing, I obviously aimed at doing the British Touring Car Championship, and everybody used to watch the Sierra Cosworths or the Rovers fighting, and the Capris before that, all fighting for the lead. But the guy in the 1.6 Astra, of which there are only three cars in the class, two laps behind the real focus of the race, was the guy that won the championship. And I think John Cleland will fit into that category. But having said that, when he did jump into the faster cars at the front, he still won. So, you know. But it's a one-class championship is the best championship, because we're out there to win on level playing field. And if you pick a car which is different to everybody else's in a class which is badly subscribed, it's a bit of a hollow victory. And I think Tom would agree with that. The present format of touring cars is fantastic. The cars are all very equal. And if they aren't equal, Alan Gow makes them equal. put a bit more weight in, turn a bit of boost down, it makes it all equal. So in the end, it comes down to the racing. I mean, I watched Tom at Alton Park last weekend. I mean, sticking a similar car to everybody else's on pole by more or less half a second is unbelievable.
Very kind of you, thank you.
But he did put that down. You put it down to a short wheelbase. Your car is a shorter wheelbase than others and therefore made it more manoeuvrable through the tight bits of Alton?
I think there's a combination of a lot of things that sort of just work with the championship at the moment. And I think with it being so close, exactly like you've picked up on, it's so close that actually the difference is so negligible between cars that when you've got it and everything works at the same sort of time, when the engine's working and the, you know, your chassis is working underneath you and your brakes are exactly where they need and the damping all works, that's then when you all of a sudden seem like you've got a car underneath you that you can do it. So, you know, some circuits we go to suit us really well. Alton, Croft, Snetterton, for example, tight, twisty stuff. We might go to Thruxton, doesn't quite suit us quite as well. So you find over the course of the season, actually, that you have these peaks and troughs where the cars come into their own. When we came here, for example, the BMWs were untouchable, yet the other circuits that we're going to, they're starting to struggle. So each car has its own little strengths, exactly like, you know, like it kind of always has been. And that's the beauty of the championship, is you never really know what's going on. And we've obviously got this TTB thing with the old boost that we've got on a button that is never as big a penalty as it used to be when you were firing ballast and weight in the side of the car. So there's now maybe an argument to say, from a purist and from a sporting fan, a sporting perspective, it's probably closer now than it ever has been to be the fastest cars and the fastest drivers towards the front, certainly in qualifying and the races, which is nice.
Well, I suppose, Patrick, that's something you didn't have, because obviously it wasn't balanced. So if you had a good car, great. If you didn't,
It was balanced by budgets, really. Yeah. Really.
I mean, we've asked you a lot over the years about the Peugeot 406, but actually, the Mazda ZDOS 6 is here this weekend, which is a fantastic looking bicycle. In fact, we've got the road car over there, a very rare road car now as well. So what do you remember about the Mazda programme? Like, it was, you had sort of flashes of pace, but never quite came together enough.
Well, the rules for the Toka British Touring Car Championship were written back there in 1992, and probably the first generation of touring cars, of which you'll see out there, they're the non-winged cars, were as what was intended. And that was when manufacturers came along, spent a little bit of money, and went racing. But popularity was the death of it in the end. Because it was so popular on TV, Alfa Romeo decided, well, okay, we've got 25,000 off cars, which were basically reps cars, but we'll put an optional spoiler in the boot and give it aerodynamics. And that means all the other manufacturers had to come up with a similar thing, which they weren't prepared to do. So Toka said, right, everybody can have aero. And that equalized the cars a little bit more, but then you had to go into a wind tunnel. You had to do lots of testing to find out the right package and have it homologated at the start of the year. All of a sudden, it started getting more and more expensive. But the Mazda was a great car because it was within the spirit of Toka. It was competitive. And it was only a one-car team on a small budget because it was only Mazda UK that financed the car. But an interesting thing I found out today about the Mazda, why is it purple and yellow? Does anybody know? Why is it purple and yellow? Because a friend of Roger Dowson that built the car was Noel Edmonds. And he had the Noel Edmonds whatever show with Mr. Blobby. And the whole car was going to be sponsored by the BBC and the Noel Edmonds whatever show. And hence Mr. Blobby. But it never happened. But they'd already painted the car, so sod it, let's leave it purple and yellow. So that's why it was going to be a Mr. Blobby car.
And I'm glad it wasn't. You'd have been in a Mr. Blobby race suit?
Hopefully not, but probably, yeah.
That would have been marvellous, wouldn't it?
Now, I don't want to give away your age, Tom, but while Patrick was driving for Mazda, that's when you were born, basically. So what do you remember of, like, how soon, when did touring cars come into your psyche? When did you think, oh, that's a cool thing? Did you kind of pay attention to super touring, or did you kind of
later? So my sort of first memories of BTCC would have been late 90s, 97, 98, 99, sort of from those. So like the premieres and all of that kind of stuff was my stuff. I'd have been 7, 8 at the time watching those, coming along to brands and coming along to circuits and meeting the drivers and things like that. So that for me was my sort of, that was my generation. That was my era of watching it through.
And you would have been karting then?
Just starting, yeah. So there's a wonderful, so I went to the Autosport show in 1998, 99, one of the years. And Dad bought me the VHS of the season review. And I used to watch that before I used to go to school. And that was my...
Before you went to school? Oh, that's awesome.
Of a morning. Every morning I used to watch a race. And I'd become completely fanatical about it. And I would watch you became that fanatical about it that you would pick up on the most minute details that now you would think that's crazy. Like the colour of the boots that Alain Menu was wearing, or the gloves that whoever would wear, and the switch, but all sorts of sort of weird and wonderful things. And it became an absolute passion and fascination for me that then led through to this desire and want to then go and race.
So when you were karting and doing all that, did you aspire to be a touring car driver?
Yes.
Not a Formula One driver?
Yeah. So
why did you not want to go the single seater route and be the next?
Because Dad doesn't own
airman.
Because Dad doesn't own any oil or a country.
Or an F1 team.
I thought, probably not going to make it, if I'm honest with you. And I've been this height since I was about 7 as well. So I was always fairly nobbled by that. But I genuinely had no desire to do it at all. I have an interest in it. Obviously, I'll watch it and support it and follow it, but nowhere near to the same level of enthusiasm that I had for the BTCC. So much so that my first go-kart that I got was red. Why was it red? Because I was a Matt Neal supporter. He was in his red Primera. That was my level of fascination. I wanted to do that. I've said this story no end of time. I've got to find it. There's a great photo of Matt Neal and I at the Autosport show in whatever year it was, and I'm 5, 6 years old, stood next to Matt, looking up at this giant. I mean, we still look up at him like that now, but looking up at this giant of a man, and I come to about his knees. I've got to find it because it was lovely.
So you're a total motorsport geek. You come across as being so normal. You hide it well most of the time.
Yeah, but thanks. Yeah, you can smell it when you get close. Yeah.
Patrick, I think on this stage of last year we talked about you bringing the 406 back. In fact, I think you even spoke to Laurent Aiello for some setup tips. So why is that not out? Is it going to be out soon? Where are you?
Jeff Page, who's just over there, is building the engine, and I'm not hurrying him along. And when you don't hurry an engine builder along, it takes a long time. But I'm in no rush, and I'm every time I come here, I'm motivated to get the 406 out. That's the 406 that I didn't race it in the UK. I raced it in Australia when Peugeot Australia bought the whole team. When UK packed it in, when Harvey and Radisich were driving, they packed it in at the end of the year. The whole lot went to Australia, and they employed me to drive it in Australia. And it was very successful over there, and I led the Australian Touring Car Championship for a couple of races. And then the car sat there for a number of years until someone said to me at the Autosport show, do you realise they're going to have a Super Touring Series? And then I asked about the prices were going up. Hey, now's the time to phone up Australia, find out where those cars were. And they were sitting in the warehouse, not being touched, covered in dust, been there for like 15 years. So I bought the whole lot back, sold one to New Zealand. That's come back, and that's racing here with Colin Sowell. It gives a nice memory, not of racing it in the UK, but racing in Australia where it was run by a proper team.
Can you outline, yeah, we'll skip over that one quickly. Can you outline some of the challenges of running the cars now? Because that was what you were saying before, they got more and more sophisticated, you know, big factory teams running them. And to run them at an event like this is quite difficult, isn't it? So can you outline some of the challenges and things you have to overcome?
There are some super tourers out there, like the story about the Primera, where a guy is running a Primera in this historic, the door gets dented. So the next day he goes down to the breaker's yard, trying to find a 1997 Primera door. Sure enough, there it is. He takes it home, paints it all up, goes to fit it. It's 2 inches bigger than a standard door. They go out and get an engine block and, right, standard engine block, let's bore that. Oh, it's totally different. Everything was, I got a Mondeo. Okay, here's a windscreen from Mondeo, doesn't fit. The Peugeot, everything fits because the cars were within the spirit, should I say. The Peugeots are easier cars because it is a standard MI16 block. It is a standard MI16 head. A lot of the cars out there, the bits are very, very special and very, very expensive, therefore, to replicate. So you don't want to be denting these cars. You don't want to be blowing up the engines. I think there are about 6 gearbox castings for the Peugeot in existence. That's okay. That will do me my lifetime. Yeah, that's the problem. It's getting hold of these very special bits. It'll cost money. But it's an interesting thing that the value of these cars might be 100, 150,000 quid. Yeah? To build a replica would cost you three quarters of a million to build a replica. If you get a lightweight E-Type that's raced in period, that's worth $1 million. But you can build a replica for 200,000. These cars are a lot cheaper than building a replica.
At the moment,
yeah. But all the time, people like Tom are sort of saying nice things about them, and you're having this show. It advertises it to people here. I mean, I bet there are guys here who watched the Super Touring in the 90s who came along with their dads and are about this high, yeah? You guys now are getting on to your 40s or 50s. You're about to inherit the farm and everything else. Sell that, buy a Super Tourer.
and then enter it here so that we can have a bigger, you know, more cars. And, well, actually, Tom, that's a brilliant time to bring you in. So you've raced the RS500. So if we were to get you onto the Super Touring grid next time, what Super Tourer would you pick? What would you say? Yeah, that's the one.
I know somebody that's got a Peugeot who doesn't currently, you know, I guess would be looking for somebody. So a Peugeot would be a lovely car to drive. If you know of anyone that would be interested in.
And a car not owned by somebody sat nearby.
Colour? Green and gold?
Probably a green and gold one, to be honest.
White and red one's nice up there.
Oh, is there one over there? I've been a fan of it. In fairness, the car that I would love to drive was the Primera, because that was the car that I supported when I was growing up. So probably the Primera. But in fairness, having an opportunity to drive one would be amazing, because although now we look at it and as to say we're doing faster lap times than we were, you know, back in the Super Touring days, actually we're 300 kilos heavier. We're, you know, with half the amount of this, double the amount of that. So to jump into something, and I know there's a little bloke called Jake Hill who's driven a few of them and has said wonderful things about them. So I would like to jump in one, that's for sure.
Well, before we finish up, I've got one more question for each of you. Patrick, when are you next going to be out on track? Either with the 406 or something else? Well, racing. I know you're demoing today, aren't you?
In 15 minutes. In the Metro Turbo.
Have you got any races?
Amy drove it yesterday. She's at a christening today with her goddaughter. So I let her drive it yesterday. And she did a 146 round the Grand Prix circuit, which would have put her midfield.
It's nice to hear you're not a competitive family and you've gone, right, she's done a 46, I've got to make sure we're
in a demo.
Yeah. She is really cross that we're on the short circuit today, so we can't compare lap times.
And you've got a break now. Well, this is your break, I suppose, but in the touring car calendar. What other things you've got lined up, Tom, before Croft? Any more outings and anything?
No, I think I've got a fairly quiet one. I've got the Grand Prix next weekend. With a load of guests and sponsors, but no, I'll be back out. Hopefully, be back out later on if we can get the car fixed.
Prop shaft at the moment.
Well, I don't really want to say that because Patrick earlier said if it's a gearbox, clutch, prop shaft, it's usually the driver's fault.
Right. Yeah.
Now I feel kind of awkward to be sat here saying the prop shaft.
You already told me that before we came on, so I don't think you could change it now.
And in fairness, I bought Patrick's book that he wrote, the Racing Driver's Book of Excuses. Great book, I must say. You did well on that one. I found the prop shaft section, and I'm currently just flicking through how I get out of taking blame for it.
Well, let's hope you do get back out there. Well, thank you very much, Tom Ingram. Thank you very much, Patrick Watts. Thank you very much for joining us. We'll be back at 3:45 with Colin Turkington and Anthony Reid.